December surprise, as I call it, the politics of terror and the exoneration of the secret team. Bear in mind now that we've seen a couple of key people, key U.S., actually a couple more than that, several key U.S. counterterrorist experts go down on Flight 103. The bombing there attributed to Abu Nidal by some in some quarters. Abu Nidal reportedly surfaces shortly after the bombing, 7 days later. He hadn't been seen in a while. And recall that Abu Nidal connected not only with Muammar Gaddafi at this point, whose terrorist cadre and national security establishment were trained and armed by the Triple Wilson operation and the secret team, but in addition, Abu Nidal is connected with Mansour al-Qassar, an associate of, among others, Odfried Hepp and Oliver North. Okay, so Qassar, Abu Nidal, Abu Abbas, Odfried Hepp, Oliver North, all in the same milieu. I realize it's kind of confusing, that's why I'm repeating all of these names. Now, the thing that I think is so significant about the crash of Flight 103, given the 12488 Bob Woodward story and its disclosure that there were very sensitive documents about joint U.S. counterterrorist, joint U.S.-Israeli counterterrorist operations in 85-86, the minute that Abu Nidal's name was connected with the downing of Flight 103 and with the possible assassination of several key U.S. counterterrorist officials, the documents disclosed in the 12488 Washington Post story, and undoubtedly touching on the same milieu that Oliver North was involved in, would have become the most sensitive documents arguably around because of their central position to any investigation into Flight 103. Let me try that one again, because it lies at the core of this hypothesis. Because Abu Nidal, associate of Mansour al-Qassar, and through him, Oliver North, because of Abu Nidal's connection, or apparent connection, at least in the news media, to this incident, any papers, such as those papers alluded to in the 12488 story, any documents pertaining to the counter-terrorist efforts against Abu Nidal, who was very much involved in the 85-86 terrorist incidents, those documents would have become very, very sensitive. There is no way that the Reagan White House or the conservative Republican prosecutor Lawrence Walsh would have mandated the disclosure of these documents, because with the crash of Flight 103, allegedly perpetrated by Abu Nidal, and which killed several key U.S. counterterrorist experts, those documents would have become totally sensitive, absolutely central to the investigation of Flight 103, thereby providing a very clear rationale for the dismissal of the conspiracy charges against Oliver North. That did in fact happen less than 2 weeks later. It should be noted also that given the horrifying aspects of the crash of Flight 103, public sentiment certainly would not favor the disclosure of any documents that might bring these killers to justice. So I think we may very well be looking at a very brilliant stratagem in which, again, a lot of linebackers may have been frozen. I wonder, and again, this is a hypothesis, how many people that might have had information to disclose about the Iran-Contra scandal were neutralized, frozen linebackers in my football metaphor, by first, Pizza Connection 4, that bust performed jointly by the FBI under William Sessions that joined the Lockerbie investigations, and Rudolph Giuliani, whose name's going to crop up in another article here in a second. I wonder how many linebackers were frozen by the disclosure of Pizza Connection 4 lapping on so many different shores of the Iran-Contra scandal. Then, the same day, the death of Amiram Nir. I wonder how many people, given all of the other Iran-Contra-related deaths that might have spoken up, felt intimidated as they noticed that Amiram Nir was no longer on the scene. Then, with the December 4th, 1988 Washington Post story revealing the existence of documents relevant to joint U.S.-Israeli counterterrorist operations in 85 and 86, headed up by North and Amiram Nir, the existence of those documents would have provided a ready-made excuse for the Reagan administration, which announced on that same day, December 2nd of 88, that they weren't going to release sensitive documents. That would have provided a ready-made excuse to hang on to any documents relative to Abu Nidal, Mansour al-Qassar, or any of the players on the terrorist and counterterrorist stage of 1985 and 86, and that would have involved all of the key players in the Iran-Contra scandal, certainly Oliver North. I wonder, too, how many people might have felt further intimidated by the deaths of the CIA and DIA and State Department counterterrorist experts. At least three went down, perhaps more. There may have been as many as six. There was an unnamed person as well, so I think we're looking at least four, possibly five deaths, maybe even six, as indicated at the beginning of the broadcast. Now, again, I think as soon as Abu Nidal's name surfaced in connection with the flight, and as soon as he then appears later, any private or public rationale for disclosing the relevant documents to the North Defense Team would have gone out the window. North requested thousands and thousands of documents, I think some 9,500 different documents, or pages of documents, I'm not sure which, relevant to one aspect or another of national security. This is called gray mail, and we're going to talk about the gray mail scenario here in a second. Now, the deaths of the State Department, CIA, and DIA officials were compounded with another interesting death on the... there's several more interesting deaths in connection with the downing of Flight 103. One of the most interesting was the death of a U.S. Justice Department Nazi hunter named Michael Bernstein. Accounts of Bernstein's death were carried in the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, January 3rd of 1989. A small story headlined, "Library Named for Crash Victim." The Justice Department has announced that it will dedicate its law library to Pan Am crash victim Michael Bernstein, who worked as a war crimes investigator in the criminal division. When Flight 103 exploded, Bernstein, 36, was coming home from Vienna, where he had negotiated for the deportation of former Nazis living in the United States. Bernstein had been responsible for the deportation of seven Nazis in the past 10 years. One of the things I wonder about here is whether a number of different birds were being killed with the same stone. One of the axioms of U.S. covert operations, and indeed covert operations for any other major nation, is that when they decide to move, they decide to move when that particular, when scratching that itch will satisfy more than just one itch. In other words, when our national security establishment and intelligence services decide to move, they move when that move will satisfy problems at a number of different levels. Now, we have talked at great length on this broadcast, and Mae Brussel has worked in a primary way for many, many years on the influence of the U.S. national security establishment of Nazi collaborators and war criminals brought in at the end of World War II under the auspices of the Gehlen Organization, the Nazi Eastern Front Intelligence Organization that jumped to the U.S. at the end of World War II, and Project Paperclip, under which top Nazi scientists, many of them SS men and war criminals, were also incorporated into the U.S. defense industry at that same period of time. The Nazi and Gehlen links, which occasional callers to this program poo-poo as no longer being relevant, surfaced in a big way, not only in connection with various aspects of the Iran-Contra scandal, but also in connection with the recent campaign of George Bush. Again, in an archive show dealing with the Nazis and anti-Semites on George Bush's campaign, also in another archive show called The Political Resume of George Bush, done just before the election, some of the Gehlen alumni working on the Bush campaign through the Republican Ethnic Heritage Council were talked about. And again, those archive shows available from Archives on Audio. Now, in Radio Free America number 3, and later again in a big way in Radio Free America number 22, we talked about the profound Gehlen and Nazi links on Middle Eastern terrorism. This subject was taken up again in a big way in Radio Free America number 32 about the Iran-Contra scandal. We also talked about it in connection with the discussion of the fascist third position, a two-part miscellaneous archive series also available from Archives on Audio. Now, in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal, and specifically in connection with some of the aforementioned terrorist elements, i.e. Abu Abbas, Abu Nidal, Manzer al-Kassar, those individuals all connected with, in turn, Oliver North and Ottfried Hepp, we find some of these Nazi Gehlen connections. Recall that in Radio Free America shows number 3, and also to a certain extent number 4, and later number 22, we talked about how the first Palestinian terrorists were formed by a U.S. Gehlen contingent to the Middle East headed up by Otto Skorzeny. This group, in turn, formed the first Egyptian intelligence service and military intelligence service, first intelligence service and general staff, I should say. Then they formed the Libyan secret service and also formed the first Palestinian terrorists at this very same time. Otto Skorzeny, the head of that mission, has maintained, or maintained up until the time of his death, an ongoing working relationship with Muammar Gaddafi through a fascist terrorist consortium linked with a number of Western intelligence agencies, including our own, called the Internationale Fascista. That's from the book The Great Heroin Coup by Henrik Krüger. Again, RFAs numbers 3, 4, and 22 go into that connection, primarily programs 4 and 22. The Galen connections to Middle East terrorism also cropped up again in Radio Free America number 30 when we touched on Stanford Technology, its connections with International Imaging Systems and TCI, a company involved with electronic surveillance, counterintelligence, and electronic warfare that was headed up by Otto von Bolschwing, according to an article by Pete Carey in the San Jose Mercury, the head of Galen's North American operation, according to an undisclosed source. Von Bolschwing, certainly a key Galen operative, a key SS man during World War II, and for our purposes significant not only because International Imaging Systems was part of his organization, then part of Albert Hakim's Stanford Technology, a key player in the Iran-Contra scandal, but again, Helena von Damm has an as yet undetermined relationship with Otto von Bolschwing, apparently considerably closer than what she has been willing to disclose. Any event, more Nazi Galen links to the Iran-Contra scandal. Again, the entire geniture of Middle Eastern terrorism is inseparable from some of these Galen and Nazi links. Earlier in the broadcast, I alluded to Haj Amin al-Husseini, a former SS major in the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, according to Erna Paris, in her book Unhealed Wounds, which we talked about in a supplement to RFA number 22. Haj Amin al-Husseini worked with the very same Galen-Skorzeny CIA contingent that formed the first Palestinian terrorists. So also did François Genoux, a Swiss national and pro-Nazi who not only worked for the Third Reich during World War II, but who also worked with that very same CIA-Skorzeny-Galen contingent that Haj Amin al-Husseini worked for. One of Haj Amin al-Husseini's protégés was a guy named Hassan Salameh. His son, Ali Hassan Salameh, followed in Hassan Salameh's footsteps, was the planner, according to our information, of the Olympics massacre in 1972. He went to work for CIA shortly thereafter. That also covered in RFA number 22. Now, interestingly enough, the West German arms firm that played a key part in the Aria arms transaction, which involved, again, Manzer El-Kassar, the drug dealer and arms trafficker linked to Abu Nidal and Abu Abbas, two key players on the terrorist stage of 85-86, Manzer El-Kassar tabbed by Oliver North to get the weapons for the Contras that were shipped on the, I believe it was a Danish ship, the Aria, E-R-R-I-A. Now, the broker for a key portion of this weapons transaction was a company called Merex. Merex, according to information we dealt with both in Radio Free America number 21 and later in Radio Free America shows number 22 and a supplement to number 32 and a supplement to 34, Merex had served as a front for BND arms shipments to terrorist elements. Among the terrorist elements that received the BND arms shipments were P2-linked elements connected with the fascist third position, notably Guido Gianettini, a P2 member, Italian fascist, and a person who served as the Italian end of some of the key BND Merex weapons transactions. Merex, founded by a World War II Skorzeny associate named Gerhard Mertens. Mertens worked for Skorzeny during World War II and relied heavily on Skorzeny for developing Merex, used as a front for the BND, the fourth and final incarnation of the Galen organization when it became the West German CIA. Merex, tabbed by the North Manzer El-Kassar operation to get the weapons for the Aria. Recall also that Otfried Hepp, a key West German neo-Nazi, is an associate of Abu Abbas's, the fellow credited with the Achille Lauro hijacking, one of the most important of the terrorist incidents in 1985. Now, I mention these Nazi connections because, again, Michael Bernstein, one of the U.S. Justice Department's top Nazi hunters, died in the crash of Pan Am Flight 103. One of the most exhaustive pieces of work that Mae Brussel has ever done, and something which I'm very proud to say I worked with her very closely on, was a very, very important series of revelations that she developed in the first quarter of calendar year 1982 concerning CIA and military influences on the airlines. One of the things that was disclosed was that CIA and national security connected elements, airlines and people associated with airlines with apparent connections to the CIA or other intelligence services, had developed a means in connection with the airlines of programming by computer the passenger list for any given flight to a high degree. In other words, a large number of airlines have their passenger lists drawn up by computer. One of the implications of this article, and again, I wish I could provide you with more detail, but this was a massive, massive series of articles over several months, and I can only give you a sketchy view of it at this distance in time and under the circumstances. But the implication was that it is possible by computer for airlines and travel agents to program the passenger lists for any given flight to an enormous extent. This came upon this in connection with, among other things, the crash of an Air Florida plane in December of 1981, or perhaps it was January of 1982, and a lot of interesting people died aboard this plane in connection with Watergate. A crash of United Flight 553 eliminated a number of key players on the Watergate stage, including Dorothy Hunt, and in connection with the crash of United Flight 553, the Air Florida plane in the winter of 81-82, and in connection with the crash of Pan Am Flight 103 this past December, the possibility of programming a number of different annoying individuals onto the same plane to be gotten rid of is not at all improbable. In fact, given the potential of computers and given the intersections between the computerized reservation system set up by the airlines and, in turn, airlines with documented connections to CIA and the National Security Establishment, it is quite possible. And again, I simply mention this because the death of Michael Bernstein aboard this crash does raise some questions. I wonder what it says here he had been responsible for the deportation of 7 Nazis in the past 10 years. One wonders if perhaps he had become a thorn in the side of the National Security Establishment as well as the worldwide fascist community because of his Nazi hunting efforts. And I wonder whether perhaps he too was looking into some of the Nazis that may have touched on the fascist networks that were brought to light in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal. In connection with, again, Nazism and terrorists here, I think two of the things that should be discussed are two of the things to be discussed are the scenario here of provocation and Schrecklichkeit. One of the major themes of these broadcasts over the years has been that the U.S. National Security Establishment, as a result of the significant German influence upon it due to the Galen and Paperclip operations, has developed not only a penchant for a type of terrorism known as provocation, in which you set up a terrorist incident to be blamed on your opponents, but has begun, just as the Germans before them did, the systematic use of what the Germans referred to as Schrecklichkeit, which translates frightfulness. And indeed, it's not much of a jump from terrorism to frightfulness, or Schrecklichkeit, which was the main Nazi methodology, the systematic, deliberate use of terror and intimidation in order to silence those opponents who you did not choose to immediately liquidate. Now, in connection with this, we've taken a look at the Rex 84 martial law contingency plan that was being drawn up by Oliver North and company, also George Bush as well, according to information in the Miscellaneous Archive show on George Bush's political resume. Now, the Rex 84 martial law contingency plan involved the rounding up of Central American refugees and American political dissidents and their internment in concentration camps in the event of a U.S. invasion of Central America or a terrorist incident in the United States. Information developed by the Christic Institute indicated that not only was the so-called secret team, a translation, our national security establishment, involved in the La Penca bombing in May of 1984, which was blamed initially on the Sandinistas, but that also that they were contemplating blowing up the U.S. embassy to Costa Rica, killing U.S. Ambassador Louis Tams, blaming that on the Sandinistas, and using that as a pretext for invading Nicaragua. This was discussed both in RFA 29 and in Radio Free America number 32. The Rex 84 martial law plan would have involved the deputization of survivalists, ultra-right-wingers, Klansmen, and neo-Nazi types as special deputies in special national defense forces. And the thing that's so terrifying about seeing this basically a fascist plan, and that we referred to it as just that in RFA 32, and to see, on the other hand, Oliver North's connections to documented terrorists such as Manzur El-Kassar, associate of Abu Abbas, and Abu Nidal, two of the main terrorists that Oliver North was supposedly fighting, along with Amiram Nir, in the 1985-86 U.S.-Israeli counter-terrorist operation. And again, the Reichstag scenario, the scenario of provocation, front and center here. We mused aloud that perhaps had Oliver North been able to pull the right strings on this terrorist puppet stage of his, that Rex 84 might have come into being. Certainly, given the ongoing connections between members of the secret team and so many different terrorists that we supposedly oppose, such as the Red Brigades, Japanese Red Army faction, elements of the IRA, Palestinian factions, all of which at one time or another, the Gaddafi situation, all of which at one time or another were trained by elements of the secret team, the Triple Wilson operation we focused on for so long. And again, bear in mind the death of Michael Bernstein, as with other aspects of the case, food for thought and grounds for further research. Now again, it is my contention, it is my belief that quite possibly the various deaths, the death of Amiram Nir, the deaths of the CIA, DIA, and State Department counterterrorist specials, as well as the threat of indictment and prosecution posed by the bust of Pizza Connection 4, that in essence these incidents combined to intimidate many of the people, many of the linebackers that might have provided information concerning the Iran-Contra scandal were frozen by these play-action passes, so to speak. Okay, again, maintaining that metaphor. And it is my absolute contention that the downing of Flight 103, the subsequent floating of information about Abu Nidal as possibly having been connected to this, the same Abu Nidal connected with Manzur El-Kassar, Oliver North's pal, that this absolutely precluded the release of any of the documents pertaining to Oliver North, Amiram Nir, the 85-86 counterterrorist operation, Manzur El-Kassar, Abbas, Abu Nidal, etc., that those documents absolutely could not have been released once Flight 103 went down. On the contrary, they would have been among the most sensitive documents in the possession of the U.S. National Security Establishment because of their central position in any ongoing investigation of this terrorist outrage. And because of the outrageous nature of the incident, public sentiment would have certainly mitigated against the release of those documents. The failure of the White House and the government to release those documents requested by Oliver North's defense team mandated, less than 2 weeks later, the dismissal of the conspiracy charges against Oliver North. Reading from the Los Angeles Times of Friday, January 6th of 1989. A story by Sarah Fritz and David D. Savage of the Los Angeles Times at Stateline, Washington, headlined, "Experts see a basic weakness in Walsh's case against North." President Reagan's critics charged Thursday that he gave former aide Oliver L. North a backdoor pardon by refusing to release sensitive documents for North's trial, but lawmakers and legal experts said that the stalemate had only exposed a basic weakness in the government's conspiracy case against North. "I am not really surprised," remarked Representative Lee H. Hamilton, Democrat of Indiana, who was co-chairman of the lengthy congressional Iran-Contra investigation in 1987. "From the start, there was some question whether the indictment on conspiracy was a charge that could hold up," unquote. In addition, congressional investigators said that they had no reason to doubt the administration's contention that national security would be jeopardized if the government supplied the documents that North contended he needed for his release. "A pocket pardon," unquote, is how People for the American Way, a liberal civil liberties group, characterized the decision by independent counsel Lawrence E. Walsh to dismiss the major charges against North because of the administration's refusal, on national security grounds, to supply documents sought by the prosecution. And again, it is my contention that linebacker Reagan was frozen, quote-unquote, by the downing of Flight 103. When that plane went down, when Abu Nidal's name surfaced in connection with it, once the existence of key documents about the 85-86 U.S.-Israeli counterterrorist operation were disclosed by the death of Amiram Nir, there was no way that those documents were going to be released to Oliver North's defense. And indeed, there had been widespread speculation about the use of gray mail, as Oliver North's defense technique was known, to get Ollie and company off the hook. Now, that very same day, or actually in the Los Angeles Times of the previous day, that was from January 6th of 1989, one day earlier, on January 5th of 1989, there was another key dismissal of charges in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal. Reading from the L.A. Times, again, of January 5th, 1989, one day before the article I just read you, an article by William C. Rempel, R-E-M-P-E-L, of the Los Angeles Times. It's headlined, 12 freed of charges in brokers of death, unquote, arms case. Conspiracy charges against a retired Israeli general and 11 other international businessmen were dropped by federal prosecutors in New York on Wednesday, nearly 3 years after they were accused of being brokers of death, unquote, for trying to negotiate a private $2.5 billion arms sale to Iran. The case, scheduled for trial in March, had been entangled in the Iran-Contra scandal ever since the White House-sanctioned arms initiative with Iran was exposed in the fall of 1986, 6 months after 10 of the defendants were arrested in New York and Bermuda. Key defendants in the New York prosecution, including Nico Minardos of Beverly Hills, were close associates of Saudi Arabian financier Adnan Khashoggi, a middleman in the secret U.S. arms-for-hostages deal. Minardos and others had said, both in unguarded remarks recorded by federal undercover agents and in subsequent court papers, that they expected White House and Israeli government approval for the arms sales. In an apparent reference to the White House arms initiative, prosecutors said in a written statement that, quote, new facts and developments, unquote, that had emerged since the indictments were filed had strengthened the defense case. Defendants, along with Minardos, were former Brigadier General Avraham Bar-Am, an Israeli war hero, Samuel Evans, a London-based American attorney for Khashoggi, and a group of Israeli, German, and British businessmen. Evans' attorney, Lawrence Bader, welcomed the decision to drop charges but said it came 2 years too late. Once the scope of the White House-Iran arms deals was known and they compared what the White House was doing with what our clients were saying on those undercover tapes, they should have dropped the case, Bader said. They don't know anything today that they didn't know 2 years ago. Attorney Ronald Kuby said the case was dropped because U.S. Attorney Rudolph W. Giuliani, whose Manhattan office was handling the prosecution, quote, realized he was not only going to lose a headline case, but he was going to drag the new Bush administration through the muck of Contragate in the process, unquote. That last sentence again. Attorney Ronald Kuby, K-U-B-Y, said the case was dropped because U.S. Attorney Rudolph W. Giuliani, whose Manhattan office was handling the prosecution, realized he was not only going to lose a headline case, but he was going to drag the new Bush administration through the muck of Contragate in the process. The surprise decision to drop charges brought an abrupt end to the long-running and controversial case that began as an undercover sting investigation by the U.S. Customs Service in December of 1985. The sting was masterminded by Iranian arms merchant Cyrus Hashemi, then a fugitive from federal indictment on unrelated arms sales to Iran. Hashemi became a government informant, however, only after he tried and failed to become a paid middleman in the U.S.-sanctioned arms deals with Iran, CIA, and Congressional Investigative Records. Wait a minute, that's a bad sentence here. Wrong sentence. Hashemi became a government informant, however, only after he tried and failed to become a paid middleman in the U.S.-sanctioned arms deals with Iran, CIA, and Congressional Investigative Records revealed. Tape recordings made by Hashemi and undercover customs agents show that Minardos, Evans, and others involved in the early stages of the case, which coincided with the period when President Reagan was being asked to sign an intelligence finding authorizing arms sales that were already occurring, resisted explicit suggestions by Hashemi that they engage in an illegal arms deal. The tapes show what, in retrospect, was remarkable detail about what was going on secretly in the White House. For example, one of their associates says in December of 1985 that newly appointed National Security Advisor John M. Poindexter had approved the sale of TOW anti-tank missiles to Iran. He had. Also, in January of 1986, the same associate was recorded saying that a paper was on the desk of Vice President George Bush awaiting his signature to approve secret arms sales to Iran. The next day, the finding was signed, not by Bush, but by Reagan. The businessman also knew that the arms deals were opposed by Secretary of State George P. Shultz and Defense Secretary Caspar W. Weinberger. Federal prosecutors, however, said they found no evidence that the White House-sanctioned arms deals with Iran involved any of those charges in this case. The much-ballyhooed arrests of Bar Am and others were followed by a televised press conference in New York at which Giuliani and Customs Commissioner William Von Raab said federal agents had prevented the brokers of death from selling arms to terrorists. Prosecutors dismissed defense claims that the businessmen expected government approval of the deal. They called such claims fantasies. Hashemi, who had been promised that charges against him would be dropped in exchange for his help on the case, died suddenly of cancer 3 months later. Prosecutors said his death also hurt their case, since he may have been able to refute defense claims that the businessmen proceeded with the deal, believing it was or would be sanctioned. Well, we've talked at considerable length about Cyrus Hashemi. Among the aspects of Hashemi's career that we took a look at were his connection with Bush associate Stanley Pottinger, a fellow who has dealt with George Bush in a number of capacities, including the apparent cover-up of the assassination of Orlando Letelier and other things for quite some time. In RFAs 30 and 31, we looked at information that J. Stanley Pottinger was a good friend of George Bush. Pottinger also was involved with both Hashemis in their arms sting, that is to say, Cyrus Hashemi and his brother. Both Cyrus Hashemi, who died of a case of galloping cancer, and his brother are now dead. And in the program, the Miscellaneous Archive show about George Bush's political resume, former CIA arms broker William Brennecke cited in a trial that, according to him anyway, Cyrus Hashemi was present at George Bush's alleged October surprise meeting in which George Bush and some of his intelligence contacts arranged with the government of the Ayatollah Khomeini to retain the U.S. hostages until after a Jimmy Carter defeat was assured in the election. It's interesting that this case, which has now fallen through and fell through at just almost exactly the same time that Oliver North's conspiracy case was dismissed, that this case could have perhaps been successfully prosecuted had it not been for the death of Cyrus Hashemi. And again, using the football metaphor, I ask perhaps, was Cyrus Hashemi frozen? In fact, was he put on ice? Was the linebacker frozen solid by this play-action pass? And I wonder how intimidating the Cyrus Hashemi death and the other deaths in connection with the Iran-Contra scandal have proved to other linebackers. I wonder whether those linebackers, too, have been frozen, given, again, the extension of our metaphor. Now, again, bear in mind that Abu Nidal, who was cited by some sources as being involved in the crash, in the blowing up of Flight 103, and who later surfaced just a few days after the crash of Flight 103, Abu Nidal has been described by many, quote, counter-terrorist experts as currently being sheltered by Muammar Gaddafi, the same Muammar Gaddafi whose secret service was developed by the CIA Skorzeny-Galen contingent in the 50s and early 60s, the same Muammar Gaddafi whose terrorist cadre was trained by and armed by the Triple Wilson team, the same group that cropped up as the main group of players, people such as Rafael Chichi Quintero, Theodore Shackley, and Thomas Kleins, etc. These are the main players in the Iran-Contra scandal. It also should be known that Muammar Gaddafi has maintained active contacts to Otto Skorzeny through the death of Skorzeny, according to Henrik Kruger, in the Great Heroin Coup. Now, again, bear in mind the Abu Nidal connection to Gaddafi. Also, I think people should bear in mind something that I will offer up to them. This isn't a hard and fast connection, as the Gaddafi-Skorzeny connection is, as the Triple Wilson Gaddafi connection is, and bear in mind that the head of the CIA when the Triple Wilson operation was mounted to train Gaddafi's terrorist cadre was none other than George Bush. And as we looked at in Radio Free America number 4, the Triple Wilson operation was not done by ex-CIA agents. According to Theodore Shackley, in an article by J. David Truby in the June 1980 issue of Gung Ho, that's a mercenary magazine similar in scope and function to Soldier of Fortune, and in that J. David Truby article called High Stakes Mercs, the aforementioned Theodore Shackley maintained in no uncertain terms that the Triple Wilson operation was an official operation. Shackley was one of its overseers, as was Thomas Kleins, head of CIA at the time, George Bush, currently president-elect. Now, after Flight 103 went down and there was the usual breastbeating about the savage terrorism of the Middle East, it also, incidentally, fulfilled the prediction of that PLO official who was quoted in that December 23rd San Francisco Examiner article when he forecast that there might be a terrorist incident, that not all Palestinian elements were under PLO control. He forecast a terrorist incident to, among other things, discredit the PLO and their diplomatic initiative by offering to recognize Israel. Recently, in fact, just this past week, a couple of Libyan jets were shot down by the U.S. 6th Fleet off the coast of Libya, and I think in many ways this will serve to, in the first place, avenge, at least to a certain extent in the mind of the American public, the downing of Flight 103. It is my opinion, and again, this is offered up for your consideration, not as hard and fast fact, but that a large percentage of the American public, a decisive one in my opinion, does not really distinguish between the various players in the Middle East. The Iranians, Syrians, Jordanians, Libyans, and others are generally subsumed, I think, by the American general public under the term diaper heads, towel heads, if you will, quote-unquote, quote, camel jockeys, unquote, other pejorative terms such as sand kickers, quote-unquote, sand niggers, quote-unquote. One hears a lot of discussion and a lot of use of terms like that. I think that a large percentage of the American people, weighed down by all of the terrorist propaganda that we've heard in connection with Gaddafi, etc., over the years, they really don't distinguish between Iranians and Arabs, even though there are profound differences, and that whenever there's a terrorist incident, they just want the U.S. to go in there and kick some butt to kill a few camel jockeys or a few sand kickers. And I think the recent military action by the United States, to a certain extent, was psychologically justified in the minds of the American people by not only the downing of Flight 103, but also the recent brouhaha concerning the alleged Libyan chemical weapons plant supplied by the Germans, among others. I can't say for sure, can't comment authoritatively of whether there is or is not a weapons plant. Apparently, chemical plants that can be used for a lot of other purposes can also be used for weapons production, according to information that's been coming out in connection with this. I also can't comment on just what those Libyan planes were doing. The information provided by the United States, I don't think, permits an intelligent decision one way or another. But the fact of the matter is that Muammar Gaddafi, a man who received his senior military training by the United States and Great Britain, a man whose secret service was developed by the same Skorzeny CIA Galen contingent that had worked for Nasser in the 50s, Gaddafi, the man whose terrorist cadre was developed by the secret team headed up by CIA Director George Bush at the time, remains a key fall guy for the U.S. national security establishment. According to information in Radio Free America number 4, Gaddafi himself may have been installed by the CIA. It's significant that in an article that emerged in the Los Angeles Times in late December that I'm going to be reading hopefully next week, the name of Edwin Wilson was mentioned as a possible supplier of the types of fuses and plastic explosive that may have been used to down Pan Am Flight 103. Edwin Wilson himself is in jail, and I have no idea whether or not some of his associates were involved in any way in the downing of Flight 103, but the fact that his name was mentioned, the fact that his name was floated in the news media, I think is very significant and something we should all think about. At any rate, bear in mind that the article from the L.A. Times about the Wilson connection will be included as a supplement to this broadcast. I should have it in my hand with it by the next week's broadcast. However, again, consider the downing of Flight 103 and consider the recent U.S. military action to Gaddafi as being sort of a question and a response, a satisfying of an itch and a craving by the American public for some action against the diaper heads. Following article, before we take our last musical break, before the last part of the show, from the San Francisco Examiner of Thursday, January 5th of 1989, Dateline, Norfolk, Virginia. This is an article by Mitchell Miller of the UPI, headlined, Gaddafi, the man they love to hate. Subheaded, no love lost for Libyan leader back in Norfolk. The home port of the carrier John F. Kennedy applauded the shooting down of two Libyan fighters, with one radio station playing a song that said, quote, we should drop the big one and kick Libya's butt, unquote. Gaddafi is a definite threat, said Skip Hollingsworth, a local merchant who served in the Air Force. I'd suggest making a parking lot out of the city where that Libyan chemical plant is, unquote. Although the official word from Navy spokesman was that U.S. ships were simply doing their job defending their country, residents of the Kennedy's home port expressed enthusiastic support for the shooting down of two Libyan MiG-23s over the Mediterranean. Skipping down on the story, Henry Del Toro, a disc jockey for WNOR-FM, whose listening audience is composed largely of military families and personnel, said telephone calls supporting the shoot-down had poured into the station. People wanted us to go nail 'em, Del Toro said. They thought we should go down there and just get it over with. It was a stupid move to get that close to the Kennedy, unquote. Del Toro, who was known as the Bull, unquote, played a recording of Dorky Man, a song he and a fellow disc jockey made to poke fun at Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi. He is a moron. He has bugs in his bed, the song begins. Take his hat off and you'll see a steel plate in his head. Ooh, what a dorky man he is. The song was recorded with disc jockey Jimmy Ray Dunn in 1986, after the U.S. bombed Tripoli, Del Toro said. And again, bear in mind the Pan Am Flight 103 downing and the apparent or alleged links to Abu Nidal, his links to Gaddafi, and this sort of jubilation, which has now become pretty much commonplace in the United States. If a terrorist bomb goes off, it's now kind of assumed that Ronnie, or now George and the Cowboys, will ride out there and kill a couple of sand kickers, or whatever term you want to use. And again, I think this is something to think about. Think about who put Gaddafi in business, or at least his terrorist cadre in business in the first place. Think who benefits the most from this kind of thing. Again, George Bush, head of CIA when Turple and Wilson go to Gaddafi, currently president-elect. We're going to take a musical break now and then come back with the concluding portion of tonight's broadcast.